My plan for this class is to cover the two-page outline that you have in your hands, taken, by the way, from the current Catholic Encyclopedia on the Western Schism. We talk in general about two great schisms in the history of the Church. The Eastern Schism, which broke the Eastern Orthodox Churches from unity with Rome, and the Western Schism, which preceded Protestantism. I like to have someone with a loud voice to read. Michael, would you please?
To read what?
Just read a couple of sentences and I'll make some comments. The Western Schism.
The period 1378 to 1417, in which Western Christendom was divided between two and later three papal obediences, which was brought to an end by the Council of Constance.
Okay, first, notice the period is the latter quarter of the 14th century and the beginning of the 15th century, and all a prelude to the Protestant, as we call it in English, I want to tell you, those of us who are at the mercy of English literature are the most brainwashed people in the world when it comes to the Catholic Church. The vocabulary, the data, the very words used are all loaded. There was no Protestant Reformation. There just wasn't. There was a Protestant Revolution and a Catholic Reformation. And the reason for the Protestant Revolution, among others, was the Western Schism. In other words, 70 years in having the Catholic Church split over who is the Pope, we can look back now and say that was a tragedy, but to have lived through that period was really to have seen a Catholic Church that should be united by the Vicar of Christ divided. In any case, it was then finally completed by the Council of Constance. Continue, Michael.
The death of Gregory XI on March 27, 1378, in Rome, made it necessary to proceed forthwith to the election of a new pontiff. Gregory was the last pope of the Avignon papacy and had actually transferred the curia from Avignon to Rome, where no election of a pope had taken place for 75 years.
Okay, now you notice, see, there's already a long period during which the popes, the bishops of Rome, were not resident in Rome. And who was the one that finally broke the stranglehold of the French people over the papacy? It was Catherine of Siena. So she did one thing. She broke the stranglehold of the French over the papacy. But then, having brought the Pope back to Rome. Then was precipitated a second, and we may say, in one sense, a more serious crisis. Continue.
Although it cannot be said that the situation in Rome was conducive to an orderly and quiet election, and although the election itself exhibited some irregular features, there can be no doubt that it was canonical.
Okay. Remember, for some 75 years, the popes had not lived in Rome. When finally Catherine of Siena brought the pope to Rome, then one pope died, and an election had to be held. Things were very disturbed. Nevertheless, as we are told, from all evidence that we have, it was a bona fide election. But if there is one thing that shows how pathetically, tragically human the church is, she is human both in this case, among those who are responsible for the election of the pope, and she is also, and even more seriously human, in the very popes themselves. Continue, Michael, and read slowly, please.
At any rate, the result was the election on April 8, 1378, of the Archbishop of Bari as Urban VI, the last pope chosen from outside the College of Cardinals. At the time, he seemed a very intelligent choice. Neapolitan by birth and upbringing, French and cultural outlook, he had been a curialist at Avignon, highly efficient and hardworking. It was thought that he would overcome the tensions between Italians and Frenchmen within the College of Cardinals.
Okay, now there you see that the problem, but we kind of take it for granted as just a historical fact. But it's not just the 75 years. The popes who should have been in Rome lived in France. That was just the tip of the iceberg. For centuries, I would say for upwards of 900 years, the French hierarchy insisted on approving documents from the Pope in Rome before they would be binding on the people in France. Let me repeat. For upwards of 1,000 years, the bishops of France insisted that papal documents, before they would be accepted by and then binding on the French people, they had to be passed by the French hierarchy. So true is this that, again, centuries later, when the first Vatican Council was held, 1870, that centuries after the tragedy of the popes living in Avignon, the main reason why the first Vatican Council was held in Rome, the main reason it was held was that the council would pass a judgment. And the council would pass judgment on the deliberations of the bishops. And it was the First Vatican Council that decided that the Pope's authority is not subject to the bishops. In other words, the Pope's authority is independent of the bishops. And not just in France, but everywhere. As we also know, the First Vatican Council never finished its work. The council was held in Rome, but as we also know, before the council could be completed, Rome was raided and the participants of the First Vatican Council were grateful they could escape with their lives because war broke out. In any case, the French, who had for centuries dominated the papacy, and finally, Pope Pius IX, courageously, as we know, he convened the First Vatican Council, and then they voted. They voted the Pope's authority over the Council. And not just the Pope's authority over the Council, but the Pope's teaching, that his teaching is infallible, remember, and does not depend on the approval of the bishops. So the great good that came from what has since come to be called Gallicanism, the Latin word for Frenchman is Gallicanus. And the Latin word for France is Gallia, G-A-L-L-I-A, Gaul. In any case, we have here then the Pope being elected, Urban VI, and then what happened? The cardinals, continue reading the last line, Michael.
The cardinals, however, soon came to realize that the man they had elected was far from suitable for his office. Urban developed a domineering personality, was impervious to all counsel and advice, and showed signs of insanity. Above all, he wished to restore the proper monarchic function of the Pope vis-a-vis the cardinal. At Avignon, the cardinals had assumed ever greater powers, which in their aggregate approached the form of oligarchic government, the very thing Urban wished to abolish. When the cardinals came to realize the Pope's intentions, they withdrew one by one to
Anagni.
And on September 20th, 1378, elected one of themselves, Cardinal Robert of Geneva, as Clement VII, and the Pope, ostensibly claiming that the election of Urban had been forced upon them by the unruly Roman monarch.
Okay, now that's the beginning. That's the beginning of the Western Schism. We just have to get the picture. I repeat, for almost 1,000 years, the French have, in many ways, dominated the papacy. Their bishops insisted in France of first approving every papal document that was sent to France. Unless they approved, so they thought, the papal document would not be binding on the French people. Among other ways of manifesting their independence of Rome was to have the popes live not in Rome, but in France. And this is where Catherine of Siena came in and persuaded the Pope, remember, to move back to Rome. And that really broke that scandal. From then on, there were popes in Rome, but also popes in France. We could have a whole course of 2 semesters and 8 hours every week on the centuries of struggle between France, which always considered itself the most intellectual nation in the world. The struggle between France and the papacy. And of course, there were many, many conflicts. Now the least, of course, was the rise of Jansenism, which came later on. Jansenius, a French bishop, was really a Calvinist all his life. A hard Calvinist, wrote, thought, preached like a Calvinist. He died, however, before he published his master work on St. Augustine. By the time he died, some 50 dioceses in France had gone Jansenist, which really meant had gone Calvinist. And this is well to remember because there are ideas that are emanating from France and have been coming from France over the centuries to this day. However, if I can use the term, the stranglehold that the French hierarchy had over the papacy, that, thank God, has been broken. But the showdown between the papacy and the French hierarchy we are now dealing with here. There were 20 or more historic events that we might have concentrated on in class. Why did I choose the Western Schism? One reason is because there is an American schism. As I've said more than once in this class and over the years to so many of my students, the American hierarchy has 2 conferences of bishops in America. And the one conference which has all the money, all the power, all the personnel. As one bishop told me just recently, every Monday, as sure as there's a Monday, I get a huge stack of mail from the USCC. My homework for the next week from the USCC, United States Catholic Conference. There's only one problem. United States Catholic Conference is independent of the Pope and has been since 1966 when Cardinal Dearden signed the bylaws of that non-papal conference here in Detroit. I made work for 23 years for the Holy See. Not to know what's going on, the tension, the confrontation between the Bishop of Rome and the bishops in other countries, but with resounding emphasis in the United States. Not to know that is to be blind to what's going on. In any case, these are the issues that we had better know something about. And those altar girls, very simple. That's just a footnote. Just a footnote to the tremendous power that the American hierarchy is exercising. Tremendous power. In any case, we better know about another previous schism, and a major one that took centuries to resolve. Michael, go on.
Urban's election, despite some irregularities, cannot be called uncanonical. In fact, for several months, the cardinals had acknowledged Urban as Pope, and the thesis of an enforced election emerged only gradually as they came to experience Urban's type of government. But their assertion that they had been subjected to force, however little this contention was supported by facts, offered their only means of impugning the election and presenting it as uncanonical. Soon after the election, Clement and all the cardinals took up residence in Aragon, so that Latin Christendom now had one pope, Urban VI, reigning in Rome with a new college of cardinals, and another, Clement VII, ruling from Aragon. The election of Clement was significant in two ways. One in the same college had elected two popes. Two such actions starkly demonstrated a serious defect in the law of the church, which provided no constitutional means of dealing with an obviously unsuitable pope. Once elected, a pope would become insane, imbecile, or for any other reason unfit to govern, could not be removed. The cardinals were thus forced to resort to the one canonical regulation, which left some sort of loophole. The allegation that the election of the pope had not been free. From a strictly legal point of view, their subsequent election was uncanonical, though there has never been an official papal pronouncement on the question of legality or illegality of the Roman or Aragonese lines of popes.
Okay. Now you see, behind what became, of course, one of the greatest crises till then in the history of the church. Behind the crisis, I keep repeating, was about 1,000 years of French self-assertion of, quasi-independence of the Pope. Independence, for example, in having the Pope reside in France, which you then would negative his being the Bishop of Rome. Again, elected by the French cardinals. Somebody would be friendly to the French cause. Again, prejudiced in favor of France, because at that time, as we know, the popes were also civil rulers of the papal states. And they had then to protect not just their spiritual sovereignty as vicars of Christ, but also their legal temporal sovereignty over papal territory. And even though, as we know, in 1870, when the newly formed Italian government took over the papal states, just stole them, and not just stole the property, but stole everything within that property, including hundreds of thousands of books and libraries.
The results of this,
including Jesuit libraries. Our largest Jesuit library in Rome was stolen by the Italian government. I'd say easily 300,000 volumes and maybe 50 or more thousand manuscripts, priceless treasures. When I was doing my work in Rome for my doctorate, I had to get special written permission, and not easy to get, even to consult these books and manuscripts, each one of which belonged to the Society of Jesus. The Italians just stole everything. In other words, the largest scale act of robbery in modern times was the stealing of several thousand square miles of property and all the pontifical holdings and the papal states. And as we know what the popes did, and they went into, you might say, protective custody in St. Peter's, and in protest did not even leave the sacred precincts of the Vatican until 1929, which was about 60 years later. And of course, by that time, they were using all of this. The Italian government was using everything and really gave nothing back. Then, a few acres of land were condescendingly returned to the Vatican in the city of Rome. And this is what most Catholics know almost nothing about. And of course, behind that massive robbery, other nations were involved who supported Italy in order to crush the Holy See. However, and this is not an unimportant however, among the great blessings that came to the church by being delivered from this property of the Papal States was how the popes, as a consequence, have been delivered, freed from that kind of political authority which they had for centuries. And this has been a great blessing to the church. Okay, Michael?
The results of this double headship were disastrous. The followers of each pope grouped themselves along rather clearly defined national lines. Among the adherents of Urban were the Empire, England, Hungary, Scandinavia, and most of Italy, while France, Naples, Savoy, Scotland, Spain, and Sicily adhered to Clement. Each pope anathematized his rival and all his rival's followers, so that the whole of Western Christendom found itself, at least in theory, excommunicated. It is obvious that the spectacle of two popes attacking each other in a most unseemly manner produced doubt and confusion where there had been unquestioned certainty before. The division likewise entailed for the papacy heavy loss of dignity and authority. Matters were made worse by the frequently occurring division among cathedral chapters and religious institutions, where in one body both Urbanist and Clementine followers could be found, with the result that whole orders were split into two camps.
Now, one reason, surely, that God allowed this, and altogether went down, it lasted 140 years, 75 years before, and then some 70 years after. There were two claimants, 75 years living in Avignon, and 70 years with rival claimants. In other words, if there's one thing we should learn from this, is the absolute, utter, total need we have for one and only one Bishop of Rome. And this is where, and I get telephone calls and letters from people. I cannot tell you how the followers of Archbishop Lefebvre, how they are dividing. Dividing the church. And there's no doubt, as we all know, there are many things in the Catholic Church that are unsatisfactory. Abuses of all kinds, liturgical, doctrinal, in so many ways. On the other hand, you don't solve a problem by creating another worse problem. And the followers of Archbishop Lefebvre, let me tell you, they are capitalizing on all the mistakes and failures which are being committed by Catholics. And we have got to be prudent, to put it mildly, in not allowing ourselves to be taken in. For example, a convention in Chicago, which finished this afternoon, of Catholic home school leaders. And before Friday already of last week, it became obvious that among these homeschooling leaders, there were those who are and are so friendly and well disposed to the Lefebvreites and there are so many things that externally are attractive, praiseworthy among the Lefebvreites, but at the cost of dividing the church, and specifically on the papacy. Because whatever else the Lefebvreites do not accept, it is the authority of the present pope. So what we've got is a carbon copy of the Western Schism going on right now. Continue, Michael.
This division affected even parishes where Urbanus and Clementine parish priests contended. Moreover, the expenses of the two curial households, each with its own college of cardinals and retainers, as well as the cost of the political designs entertained by them, had to be met with an increase in taxes levied upon the clergy. Heretical movements received a particular stimulus, and it is no exaggeration to say that the result was utter chaos during the period of the schism.
And this is, it was chaos then, and let me tell you, there was a lot of chaos in nominally Catholic circles now. How well I know. In other words, once you have the highest authority divided, then is it any wonder that people not be united on the final authority are divided on almost everything else, on doctrine, on morality? Continue.
Proposals for ending the schism. The means to end this disaster presented themselves in the movement called conciliarism, according to which a general council was to decide the issue and henceforth was to be the supreme ecclesiastical authority, which even the Pope was to be suggested. Postponed primarily by the University of Paris, this idea in course of time gained more and more adherence.
Now just there, actually, the idea of conciliarism, concilium, C-O-N-C-I-L-I-U-M, is a Latin word for council. And it was true that centuries before the Western Schism broke, there were those who claimed that not the Pope, but a conference or congress of bishops is the highest authority in the church. Now let's be as clear as we can. History repeats itself. We now have, for example, in our country, but not only, the Second Vatican Council decreed that every large country, and where there are smaller countries, a cluster of smaller countries should have a conference of bishops. Very well. And then that conference of bishops is to have authority. Now what has happened? In one country after another, that conference of bishops exercises authority, makes decisions, votes. Now watch this. On principle, that's PLE, on principle, no conference of bishops is allowed to make any decision which is binding on all the members of the conference without approval of the Bishop of Rome. However, as I've been saying, already in 1966, the United States Catholic Conference had declared itself independent of the Pope. And as a result, people never really know what the bishops will issue, which is approved by Rome, and what they will issue independent of Rome. Or say, as with the altar girls, the bishops had widely for years authorized altar girls. Zero permission from Rome. Zero. Then post factum, after one dies after another, and is doing all of this on its own authority, then piously asking the Holy See, would you please approve what we've been doing anyhow, and never asked anybody's permission except our own. One reason for going into the Western Schism is because it symbolizes what's going on in the modern world. Continue, Michael.
The popes themselves were, of course, adamant in their opposition to conciliarism. And when Urban died, his College of Cardinals elected Boniface IX, who did little to heal the division of Christendom. No more did Clement's successor, Benedict XIII, and the Pope, the fiery Peter de Luna, although discussions and negotiations between the two camps continued. In the same year in which Benedict was elected, the University of Paris put forward three concrete proposals for ending the schism. First, the Via Concessionis, that both popes should voluntarily resign. The Via Compromissi, that an independent tribunal be empowered to decide which pope should resign. The Via Concilii, that a decision be made by a general council. The university itself favored the first proposal. Benedict's stubbornness persuaded France and Spain to withdraw their obedience from him in 1398, resulting in the resignation of all but five cardinals. French troops besieged the papal palace at that time and kept Benedict a prisoner for 4 years. France had not, however, recognized Boniface, and the confusion became so great that a meeting of French and lay ecclesiastical princes in 1403 suggested resumption of relations with Benedict. Meanwhile, most universities proposed means of ending the schism, but every effort was nullified by the chancellery of the Pope. In the Roman line, Gregory the 12th succeeded Boniface in 1406 and initially was eager to terminate the conflict. However, when a meeting of two popes was arranged for September 1407 in Savona near Genoa, Gregory changed his mind and refused to meet his rival. The scandal had reached such dimensions that a number of cardinals from both obediences arranged a council at Pisa, that after France had declared neutrality in the papal schism in 1408. The Council of Pisa began on March 25th, 1409. It consisted of 24 cardinals, numerous archbishops and bishops, and doctors of theology and canon law, assisted by legations from many secular governors. It summoned both popes, but neither appeared, holding that the council was uncanonical. And on June 26, 1409, the council elected the third pope, Alexander V, former Peter of Candia, Cardinal Archbishop of Milan. On the death of Alexander in the following year, the Pisan and the Curia elected John the 23rd, antipope, formerly Cardinal Balthasar Casas. It was through the instrumentality and persuasive efforts of Emperor Sigismund that John convoked the Council of Constance for November 1st, 1414. Here he was formally deposed on March 29th, 1450, while the nonagenarian Gregory resigned on July 4th, 1415. Benedict, however, had pled to the nun, categorically refusing to entertain any thought of resignation. He remained pope till his death in 1423. With the election of Martin V, November 11, 1417, a schism formally ended.
Okay. It is well to know before we finish this section that the Council of Constance, which finally ended the schism,